This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 29th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 299 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Steve Bloomfield.
On the show today, we'll be talking nukes and how to make a bang in Theatreland with playwright Tom Morton Smith, whose new production looks at the life of the father of the atomic bomb, J. Robert Oppenheimer.
We'll also be hearing about the blissed out sounds of Lee Hazelwood, the original psychedelic cowboy, with Lee's former manager, Wyndham Wallace.
And we'll be seeking out tales of London after dark, told by some of the finest writers the city has ever produced, with Matthew Beaumont.
Plus, a look ahead to all the stories that matter this week with Thomas Lewis, and surely some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. And welcome to it, Steve.
Hello,
it's
Rob.
A little bit of a change of personnel this week, but I'm sure that won't jar the listeners too much. It won't scare the horses.
I certainly hope not. I was doing the news look ahead last week, and I made it abundantly clear I wouldn't do the news look ahead again until I had my own jingle. And so this week, our producer Tom Hall
just
said,
put you in the,
"We have a solution for you.
We haven't got the money for that. So what we'll do is we'll make you co-host the program. There you
basically,
go.
Basically, yes. Yeah. Now, what I want to know, Rob, is where's Andrew Tuck? Because I thought he was supposed to be here this week.
Well, I mean, it's obviously, I don't know whether anyone has read the papers, but obviously, I mean, what you can't do is punch a producer in the face and have a 20-minute verbal rant at him over a cheese platter and keep your job. So Andrew Tuck is for the moment indisposed.
He's been suspended.
we
await the outcome of that investigation.
We'll await the outcome of me saying that on the radio as well. But there we go. So maybe... I mean, wouldn't it have been nice to have made 300 of these shows? I mean, I was on the first one, but hey, you know.
Well, maybe his suspension will be lifted for episode 300.
Let's just hope. I mean, you know, let's see. How many people are going to sign the petition?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is a thing.
I mean, he's got a million to beat. One of the UK's sort of finest broadcasters. I'm quoting Tony Hall there, the chairman of the BBC, the director general of the BBC.
Well, I think he's definitely got one person who's signed a petition.
Well, his dog's only got a paw print. That doesn't count, does it?
I think that counts. Okay. That counts.
Well, we're going to welcome Thomas Lewis to do the news look ahead this week.
It'll be a Canadian theme.
Yeah, exactly.
Won't
this
it?
Is interesting for two reasons, isn't it? Because Thomas, he doesn't have his own theme tune, but he has done it before very well.
Yeah.
But he's coming to us live for down the ISDN line. That's a technical phrase. I don't know why I've added to the program. It's letting a little bit of daylight in upon magic for our listeners there who thought
is
this
that daylight?
Whole thing.
Not quite sure.
I don't know. Certainly not magic. Here is Thomas Lewis live from our Toronto office. Thomas, do you read us?
Loud and clear, Rob, here I am.
I think we got away with that, didn't we?
I think we did, yeah.
I think that worked. And it feels, you feel very close, Thomas. It feels like you're in the room, such as the high quality of your phone line. But I'm glad
you've... I thought it was an ISDN line. Rob,
well, I didn't want to wow our listeners. I didn't want to blind them with science. It feels almost like you're next to me in a good way, Thomas.
If only I were, Rob. That's the nicest thing anyone said to me all day, frankly. But it's lovely to hear your dulcet tones from across the oceans, as it were. Hope you're both doing well.
We're rocking.
How has Toronto been treating you so far, Thomas?
Toronto's treated me pretty darn well, Steve, so far, I'll be totally honest. Now, the big topic of conversation here has been the weather. I mean, as it sort of always is wherever
is that
you go,
is that really the main news in Canada at the moment?
It is, I'm afraid.
Oh,
it will
it's
get
the
better.
Weather.
Well, I've been a bit of a big girl's blouse about it, I'll be totally honest. I arrived and was sort of shivering my little sort of Welsh socks off, and everyone said, well, you don't know how awful it's been. And actually, it is getting a bit better. It was snowing on Thursday, I should say. We thought we'd seen the end of that, but the skies largely have been beautifully clear, and it's been pretty nice. It's a pretty picturesque city, Toronto. It's the sun does it very well indeed. So looking forward to more of that as the spring rolls on.
I think we should bring back weather on Monocle 24. Because remember, we had weather at the start, didn't
we? Yeah, we did weather. I quite liked it.
I quite liked it too.
It was sort of aviation-themed weather, wasn't it?
It was. It was a bit like, you know, in Geneva this weekend. But, you know...
It's quite nice to know if the sun is shining in Cardiff, for example, just plucking a city out of...
A random city.
On earth did that happen?
City, yes.
So is the weather part of your news look ahead, Thomas? Are you just going to say, I think it's going to be quite nice on Wednesday?
Basically, yes, Rob. Yeah, that's my news look ahead done, basically. So I'll speak
to you. What an easy job you've got. Yes. Okay, so what's on the agenda this week?
Well, of course, this week one month gives way to another, and we are in April, and we'll get to maybe the big event for next week towards the end of this look ahead, I thought, Rob. But on Wednesday, a bit of a diplomatic story. Jordan is taking over the presidency of the United Nations Security Council. Now, I know, Steve, a couple of months ago, you did a big report from behind the scenes at the UN Security Council, so this may be a story that interests you. But it's an interesting time for Jordan, obviously. They are... at the end of last week, it was confirmed that they were taking part in these Saudi-led airstrikes in Yemen against the Houthi rebels there. But of course, it's still sort of playing its part in the campaign against Islamic State militants as well, and still coming to terms, I think, nationally with the brutal killing of its one of its Air Force pilots at the hands of the militants there. So I think, you know, Steve, I don't know whether you think that these rotating presidencies, whether they are any more than symbolism, or whether actually if you are a country like Jordan that does find itself in a strategically sort of pivotal, I suppose, kind of moment, that actually these kind of positions do actually have some sort of sway.
Well, you certainly get to set the agenda for the month when you have that rotating presidency. And as you said, I was there a few months back when it was the UK that had the presidency, and they got to push on some of the issues that were important for them. And it would be interesting, I think, to see also what Jordan does about Israel and Palestine, because as the one Arab League member on the Security Council at the moment, they're the ones that tend to push the resolutions that are either critical of Israel or pushing for a Palestinian state. So it'd be interesting to see whether that happens.
Do you think it will sort of take it, you know, its opportunity to look sort of regionally, or because it's got such a sort of big sort of so much to deal with in its own sort of backyard, if you like, that actually it might focus on domestic issues rather than, say, the bigger picture like it has done before, as you said?
No, I think it will try and push for the bigger picture. The problem is at the moment they're going to find that there's too much in the bigger picture. And for example, they probably weren't thinking a week or so ago, oh, we must do something on Yemen, but that's going to be very, very high up the list indeed when they take the presidency.
Right, chaps, sorry to break it up. It's called Monocle Weekly.
Sounds like... Enjoy that, Steve. Thanks.
And welcome to the editorial meeting for the Foreign Desk with Steve Bloomfield.
This is the only time I get to talk to Thomas now.
Oh, you've missed each other. All right.
Exactly, I've missed it, Steve. I really have. There's a tear to my eye.
Next news story, go on.
Next news story. So I'm going to lighten the mood ever so slightly. And this is maybe one for you, Rob. So there's this a sale taking place, I should say.
How posh
Sotheby's.
You are. Is this the Ivy sale?
No, it's the Brown Sisters photographs, Rob. Now, I'm not sure if you're aware of these, but they are...
I just
stumbled across them. They're pretty fantastic things, aren't they, Steve? I don't know if you've seen them.
Yeah, it's the Brown Sisters over one photo every year for the last 40 years.
Exactly, it is. So they're being sold at Sotheby's in New York as one lot. That's on Wednesday, April the 1st. And they really are remarkable. So it all began in 1974 when Nicholas Nixon decided to take a picture of his wife and her three sisters. Didn't really like the photo very much. And then I think one of the sisters graduated the year after, so decided to take a similar photo of them all grouped together. Pretty informal, quite casual, quite intimate sort of photo. And as you say, decided to take the same photo every year for 40 years. And it's they really are quite lovely things. There was a big exhibition of them all at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. That exhibition ended in January. And I think what a sort of lovely thing to have to sort of come up for sale, I suppose, kind of to get your hands on. The fact they're all being kept together, I think, is rather lovely too.
That's a nice thing that they've kept them together as one lot. I think the auction houses have always been famous for splitting up photography collections, which you probably wouldn't do with paintings, but you can do them with photographs because they're kind of seen as slightly sort of like lower on the sort of art history ladder. So that's kind of that's a nice decision. Someone will be having to repaint a wall.
Well, right? Exactly. I'm not entirely sure. As nice as it might be to own them all, I'm not quite sure where you'd put them all.
It's a bit like Garbage Pail Kids, isn't it? You want to just swap them in the playground with your kids. This is presumably what the Upper East Siders use as cigarette cards.
Pogs. Just I've never had Pogs, Rob, in the playground.
Pogs?
Yeah.
Is that a Welsh thing?
Pogs, those little chips? No. I think it's like a South Korean thing, I think. We used to swap those little chips in the playground.
I don't know what that is.
I think that was after our
time.
It
was just my childhood. Well, I'm a lot younger than both of you, so there we are.
Okay.
Thanks,
Thomas Lewis. Go away. I think we've come to the end of our news look ahead there. That was.
I've got one final thing I think we should discuss very briefly.
Go on then.
And as April the 1st is here, of course it is April Fool's Day on Wednesday. So I just wanted to ask you both, really, what's maybe the worst prank you've either sort of committed against someone or been subject to of the April Fool's Days? The many April Fool's Days.
A couple of years ago, I had to do the Globalist.
So you did that, Ralph. Nice.
And I think I was actually given a job at a place called Monocle. I think that was April the 1st, I think it was then, yeah.
Okay. Laughing
but hey,
the
joke was on them.
I'm in a strange position of having to try to call order on this radio programme. Okay.
What was your story?
Yeah.
Do you know what? I've never played an April Fool's prank on anybody, ever.
Well, there's still time.
There is time. Maybe my new colleagues in Toronto.
You've got it before midday. Before midday, otherwise you're the fool.
Oh, that's right. Because that's right. Thank you, Steve, for that.
There we are.
I'll keep that in mind as
there are rules. Yeah, exactly. There are rules even on April Fool's Day. Thomas, you've got a plane to catch. Where are you off to quickly?
I'm off to New York City for the weekend, Rob. Looking forward to it very much indeed.
Nice.
Hope it's a little warmer, just to bring it back to the weather.
You enjoy that first cocktail, Thomas Lewis. You enjoy that first cocktail in your self-confessed little Welsh cotton socks. You called them out at the beginning.
Toast your good health, both.
Please
Thanks a lot. Happy travels. And we'll speak to you soon, Thomas Lewis. Coming up next is a chat I did with Tom Morton Smith, the playwright behind a stunning new thing called Oppenheimer.
Around the world, around the clock. This is Monocle 24.
Questa è Monocle 24.
New Yorkista Torontoon, Lontooseen, Zürichiin, Istanbuliin.
From Midori House in London, you're tuned to Monocle 24.
Tom Morton Smith is the writer behind Oppenheimer, a new play from the Royal Shakespeare Company that kicked off at London's Vaudeville Theatre on Friday. The performance looks at the life of a great creative mind whose life's work was perhaps responsible for some of the most wanton destruction known to man. J. Robert Oppenheimer, the theoretical physicist whose guidance helped create the first atomic bomb.
His is a story that splits audiences, not just atoms. So how do you go about making him a real or indeed likeable figure? Rob met Tom a little earlier to find out.
Tom, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
And first of all, that's a good question right there in the introduction. What is your responsibility to science, to history, and to giving this man some phrases that an audience, a paying sitting audience, will want to hear?
Good. Yes. Yeah. That's not a big question at all.
Well, come on. You've written a play about Oppenheimer. You can handle these big questions, I have no doubt.
Yes, yes. I just usually take 3 hours in a theatre to kind of answer them.
But it's a question of responsibility, isn't it? I mean, it's presumably something you grappled with quite a lot in the writing.
Yeah, I think he's such an important historical figure, and very few things can be said to have changed the course of history and to work as a pivot point, if you like. And the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and even the first testing in the desert of the atomic bomb is certainly one of those pivot points. And it's one of those things that, as a big historical character, he's relatively obscure to quite a lot of people.
Because I guess we don't know him in terms of quotes. We know him in terms of one invention, don't we?
Yes, yeah. I mean, there's the one quote, the "I am become death, destroyer of worlds" quote. And if anyone knows anything about him, it's that. And so it's kind of fascinating to kind of, when you start looking at his story and the politics and the history of the time, how much of what was going on with him and with the Manhattan Project and at the end of the Second World War was really a kind of dry run, if you like, of what was going to happen for the next 50 years with the Cold War and the anti-communist feeling and the mistrust that kind of permeated the world throughout the rest of the 20th century.
And how do you go about finding, I mean, other than research, and I've read that you read any novel that might have reference to Oppenheimer in it, and you've marked the page and so that you can refer to that. Is that how you start to build up a tone of voice for a man like Oppenheimer?
Yeah, I mean, he's a very contradictory and complex man, and there are decisions that he made in his life, much in the way that whenever you're writing about any real life figure, there are decisions that narratively seem a little contradictory, and you go, well, why does he say that if earlier he believed this? And so his story arc is a fascinating one to try and put across. So, yeah, I immersed myself in all the various biographies and history books, and every single scientist involved in the project seemed to have written an autobiography at some point. So trying to get a sense of who this man was and also what he represents, because this is not a documentary. It's very much my retelling of this story in order to kind of say something hopefully relevant to now and to today. So it's kind of, what does he represent? What does his journey represent to someone, to an audience who aren't, you know, building atomic bombs, but are who are just normal human beings? How do we relate to him? And how do we see ourselves in him, or how are we repulsed by him? Those are the things to kind of look at.
Because you have that strange thing where someone that was, or his invention was such a huge actor on the stage of the 20th century, and yet he himself was not a dictator, nor was he a great war leader on the Allies' side. He was an inventor. Was he jockeying for position as an inventor? Was he saber-rattling in the sense that he wanted to go to Los Alamos and do this project, do the Manhattan Project?
Well, I think because quite a lot of people at the time in the war departments in the army, when they were kind of trying to find someone to head up the Manhattan Project, they were looking for experimental physicists and people who were responsible for building particle accelerators and knew how to manage a huge, great industrial kind of projects. And he was a theoretical physicist. So he was not an obvious choice.
But he was used to a blackboard rather than a lab, presumably, before anything else.
Yeah. And he was an ambitious man, but his ambition and where he was at the time before the war wasn't to be a figure on the world stage. I mean, a figure in the world stage of physics, but not kind of on a historical level. He was very much on the fringes politically. His interests and his affiliations were quite obscure for the time. And then he suddenly found himself in a position of incredible power and influence, somewhere he had never planned in his life to be. But those are the decisions that he, you know, the world changed when atomic fission was discovered, and everyone kind of went, right, suddenly this rather worthless material, uranium, which has been used to make watch faces glow in the dark, suddenly this is now the new weapon. This is going to change the world, and it's going to be a source of power that's going to replace coal and gas and all these things. And suddenly these theoretical particle physicists are at the center of everything. And he sees that opportunity. And you know, it seems in hindsight now, when you think about the atomic bomb and you think about the radiation involved and how that makes the weapon kind of sit in a very particular place in people's imaginations, and the fact that you use it and people are killed in the blast, but then people go on dying from radiation sickness, and then people go on to develop cancers. And so even when an enemy has surrendered, people are still dying. They didn't know about that at the time. They understood radiation sickness, but they thought anyone who would get a dose of radiation big enough to make them ill, they'd be killed by the blast anyway. So the true horrors of what radiation was and how it would affect human life afterwards was unknown at the time.
Was Oppenheimer a Shakespearean character? I mean, we talked about this, and the commission originally was from the Royal Shakespeare Company for this play, wasn't it? You workshopped it, and then it, which is a fascinating process as well, actually. I mean, it'd be nice, before we get on to another, you're making face at the idea of whether or not he's a Shakespearean character. We'll save that one for the end.
Yeah.
But actually, let's talk about how you wrote the play. How much script did you go in with, and how much was it workshopped by that original group of actors in Stratford?
The original commission came from the fact that the RSC ran a couple of workshops for writers where they wanted to see how all the resource that they have available for actors, all the vocal departments and various physical coaches and rhetoric coaches that they have, how useful that would be to a bunch of writers, to see if that would inspire them to write epically and to fill in the way that they train actors to fill those theatres. They wanted to see if that would work on writers as well. So we did some workshops with all the various departments. They made me and four other writers get up on stage and read some speeches from Martin Luther King and from Henry V and do some T.S. Eliot and then some Greek chorus work. And then we were to go away and have a big idea. It's not often you get the commission.
It's a kind of luxurious place to be, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
You're not often a theatre kind of turns around and says, bring us the biggest thing you can think of. So I took them the idea of the atomic bomb. I thought, you can't really get much bigger than that.
And was that interest spurred by their question, or was that something rattling around in the back of your mind? Is that a preoccupation of yours anyway?
It had become a bit of an interest to me in the kind of preceding years. I'm not a particularly scientific person. I come from very much from an arts background, but I had developed a hobby, if you like. I'd just become fascinated in physics, and I understood the science better by understanding the human stories behind those discoveries and trying to find something that had the grandeur of a Shakespearean story arc. My brain kind of automatically went to physicists and physics.
Well, maybe he is Shakespearean. He sort of finds himself accidentally the king, doesn't he? He finds himself in charge of a kingdom, and there are huge moral implications to it and all the rest of it. So maybe is Oppenheimer a Shakespearean character?
Can we
lay that on him?
I tried not to think about it too much when I was writing it, though there are some parallels, particularly when you're talking about ambition and you're working for the Royal Shakespeare Company. You can't help but think of Macbeth. When you have a character, one of the female characters drowns herself, you can't help but think of Ophelia. So those things are always kind of there. And when we were in rehearsal, we were talking about, because Shakespeare writes so brilliantly about leadership, and so much about Robert Oppenheimer was how this theoretical man who is incredibly charismatic but slightly socially awkward suddenly rose to become an incredible military leader in some ways. So you couldn't help but think of Henry V or Richard II or any of those great plays that Shakespeare wrote about leadership. And I think Macbeth was definitely, certainly the way his wife ends up talking, it's kind of...
That's the way, without the cocktail parties and wife swapping and Los Alamos.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And just finally, do you come to it from a sense of, you talked about this, the physics became a sort of hobby. Are you coming to it with a moral question? Are you coming to it with a scientific question? Are you coming to it with simply trying to draw a picture of a very important man?
The use of the atomic bomb, the building of the atomic bomb, is such an unanswerable question, whether it was the right thing to do. It is obviously an incredibly horrible thing to have done, but trying to imagine what the world would have been like had the atomic bomb not been used during the Second World War, and that hydrogen bombs would have been developed by the Russians and the Americans kind of independently, and if there was another war, then the first weapon would be a hydrogen bomb and both sides would have it. Trying to play what ifs with how the world could have been is quite a terrifying game to play. So it's one of those big unanswerable questions. And as a writer, I'm drawn to the unanswerable questions. Was it the right thing to do? We can't know, but it is what happened. So we should look at the decision processes that led to that decision.
Great. Well, Tom Morton-Smith, thank you so much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
That was Rob talking to the playwright Tom Morton-Smith about Oppenheimer, which opened at London's Vaudeville Theatre on Friday.
We're going to be hearing about the pop genius that was Lee Hazlewood in just a moment. But first, how about a tune from Lee featuring Nancy Sinatra? This is Some Velvet Morning.
How she made it in. That was the ever fabulous pop stylings of Lee Hazlewood. We'll be meeting music writer, record label man, and Lee's former manager, Wyndham Wallace, after this.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his reports across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
For every music legend of the stage, there's a small army of backroom figures, songwriters, producers, gurus, equally worthy of the genius tag.
Pop impresario Lee Hazlewood was one of those figures from the 1950s up until his death in 2007. But with a personality as big as his booming, sun-baked vocals, the man whose loose way with words and music meant he was known as the original psychedelic cowboy kept a foot in both camps, writing and performing classics such as These Boots Were Made for Walking with Nancy Sinatra, and with his songs performed by everyone from Elvis Presley to Courtney Love.
In the latter years of Hazelwood's career, he struck up a friendship with Wyndham Wallace, the Berlin-based music writer and former UK boss of City Slang Records. Now Wyndham has compiled memories of those years into a new book. Lee, Myself and I and Monocle's Tom Hall met him earlier to learn more about a one-off pop culture classic.
Well, I mean, when I met him first in 1999, he hadn't been doing a great deal previous to that for quite a while. I mean, there had been an album that had dropped out in early to mid-90s. He'd actually done a third album with Nancy Sinatra, which came out in... That's right, excuse me. It was the third album that came out with Nancy Sinatra in 2004. And there was also another album that had come out in 94, which was done with a Finnish singer, both of which are probably best left to one side. When I met him, he had been talking to Steve Shelley from Sonic Youth, who had a label called Smells Like Records. And Steve had sort of persuaded him to reissue these records on his label. And I'd met Steve backstage at a Sonic Youth show, which is obviously the kind of place I used to hang out all the time. I was running the UK office of a label at that point. I hadn't just kind of, you know, wangled my way backstage by climbing on the bins into the window.
Well, it's an interesting trajectory, though, isn't it? I mean... how did sort of Lee come into that sort of world that you were inhabiting?
Well, as I say, I mean, I'd been at this Sonic Youth show and I'd overheard Steve talking about Lee, and I'd introduced myself because in my role running City Slang, City Slang's main office is in Berlin and they licensed a lot of US acts at that time. And I was also making a living on the side to try and keep the UK office open by doing freelance publicity. And so I had sort of, you know, poked my head into the conversation sheepishly and sort of said, "Hi, I'm a big fan of Lee Hazelwood. Why are you talking about him?" And Steve said, "We're going to try and do these reissues." And I said, "Right, well, I do freelance publicity and, you know, I would die to be involved in this project." And Steve called me a few months later and said that he'd done the deal. And it was kind of remarkable because honestly, until I'd had that conversation with Steve Shelley, I didn't know if Lee was alive or dead. I mean, there was so little information about him available. I mean, the internet didn't really exist as a sort of common tool for people. And the last that I knew was he'd been seen in the mid-90s playing on a cruise ship, I think, or something. I mean, that's how I managed to get involved. And funnily enough, when I contacted the head of City Slang and said, "Look, I might be a little bit busier than normal because I've decided it might be quite good to persuade Lee Hazelwood to come and play a show," they were all actually remarkably excited over there because it turned out that, you know, half of them were, you know, massive Lee Hazelwood fans as well. And they thought, well, at least we can get the records for free now through Wyndham.
It's funny you mentioned that cruise ship element, though, because oddly, there is just a side of his music which almost belongs there, you know, because he had this really fun sense of almost camp and whimsy. But I mean, obviously channeled through this sort of gravelly kind of uber alpha male almost sort of voice, but his music just has this sense of fun, and I think sometimes people mistake that for perhaps something that hasn't been thought about very much, you know?
Well, I mean, I guess part of the reason I came to him was through the easy listening movement in the sort of mid-90s, the same one that gave us Mike Flowers Pop. So there is that element to his music, and there is obviously an element of fun, but the element of fun is, it's very deceptive. I mean, you take a song like Sugartown, which sounds like, you know, one of the happiest, you know, summertime pop hits you're ever likely to hear in the 60s. Well, that song's about taking acid.
I never had a dog that liked me some. Never had a friend or wanted one. So I just lay back and laugh at the sun. Cause I'm in shoo shoo shoo. Shoo shoo shoo. Shoo 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 shoo. Sugar Town.
And there are all the, you know, there's a very, very dark, mysterious, sort of confusing side to Lee's music. And that was what always fascinated me about it. I mean, even These Boots Are Made for Walking. I mean, that was, you know, one of the biggest hits around the world. And, messing doesn't mean messing in Texas. Let's put it that way. So when he says, you know, "You've been messing where you shouldn't have been a messing," she's a little bit more upset than perhaps she sounds.
Oh, my God,
song.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was a pretty subversive songwriter. And,
yeah.
I mean, as you say, there was a fun side to him. I don't think of him as a fun writer. I think of him as a writer who is capable of being fun.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, most of his music is, you know, it's got incredible depths to it, and normally a number of different layers to it as well. I mean, he loved punning as much as anything. So,
yeah,
you know,
Don't we all?
Yeah. So that, you know, that it's a very complicated thing, and yet at the same time, it's masked in this, or you know, it's shrouded in this very approachable fashion most of the time.
Yeah.
And I think it was that complexity that prevented him from being terribly famous outside the Nancy Sinatra work, because he needed somebody like her to actually deliver that into the mainstream.
Somewhat unbelievably, some people may not have actually heard the song These Boots Are Made for Walking, which, even if it wasn't an uber hit, is just an absolute masterclass in camp fun with, as you say, quite a dark undertone now we're learning. So should we give These Boots Are Made for Walking a listen right now?
I think you should do that. It's worth bearing in mind, by the way, that this is it's written in quarter tones, which is very unusual. I think that's probably the reason that people got kind of hooked on it.
That's my favourite thing about it.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
In the book, you sort of highlight how he was, for such a, as I say, for the layman's fan, like someone who might be perceived as like a figure of fun, actually as a person he was quite introverted and would have these episodes of kind of depression and have to sort of take himself away from his family to deal with it and things like that. Hanging out with Lee, how much of that side did you have to counter, and how much was it a professional relationship, and how much was it, you know, helping out a man who obviously had his own problems?
I mean, to be honest, the problem side of him, I never really saw any of it as being problems. I mean, it was only in retrospect, really, that I started to understand maybe more of why he was the way he was. I mean, there was this key thing that was said to me at his memorial party in Arizona, that he had suffered from depression and had taken lithium when he was much younger. And that suddenly unlocked a sort of side to him that I had not really thought about. I just thought he was one of these, you know, you get these people in the music industry. You don't, actually, it's not just in the music industry. You get these people who are much older, and maybe things haven't gone quite the way they wanted, and perhaps they missed the gravy train, and they're just, you know, grumbling, grumpy old men, you know, and that's how they come. And, you know, there was this, it was like Victor Meldrew, you know, I mean, there was a bit of that to him. It's like every time he blew his lid, you kind of knew that within an hour he was going to be back down to earth.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, you know, there were times when he would roar at me, or he would send me these like really, really quite nasty faxes. But it was his way of dealing with things. And I learned to put up with that at the time. And I was in awe of him, if I'm, you know, being honest. And that's a lot of what the book is about. I mean,
yeah,
it's not a biography. It is, it's a book about somebody meeting their hero and becoming very close to him and then watching him sadly die. But yeah, I was in awe of him. So, and I didn't have a particularly high opinion of myself. And so, you know, anytime he lost his temper with me, I just thought it was probably my fault and I deserved it, because he was a legend and he'd written These Boots Are Made for Walking. So what the hell, you know?
That's what it always comes down to. He wrote Boots.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, though. It was like, you know, you have these people who've written a song like Boots, and you're like, you know, you have to respect them. But I mean, he didn't just write Boots. I mean, he did all these amazing things outside of the stuff that he's actually known for.
Yeah.
And the more that I, you know, dug into his history, the more that I discussed with him, the more, you know, extraordinary things I would learn about him.
Tell us a few things that, you know, as I say, I mean, it's a fine, fine thing to be known for, Boots, but it's obviously not the sum of the man's work. What should people maybe be focusing on that maybe, you know, isn't the first thing that we always hear about Lee?
Well, I mean, a couple of fun facts are that he gave Phil Spector an internship.
Nice.
So, and if you listen to Phil Spector's records and compare them to the ones that Lee Hazlewood was making some years before, there is an uncanny resemblance.
Right.
You know, one of the demo singers that Lee would hire to record his songs, because he was a songwriter predominantly. He didn't ever intend to be a singer. And one of the singers that he would get in to sing his songs was Glen Campbell.
Wow.
And I think Lee told me some story once of having, you know, called up Glen Campbell and said, right, I've written a bunch more songs. I need you to come down to the studio and sing them. And Glen's like, have you looked at the Billboard charts this week? Glen's like riding high. And apparently he still came in to record the songs, but, you know, it was the last time he was going to do it.
Yeah. So let's have a listen now to some of Lee's finest work. We're going to listen to Leather and Lace. What's the background to this song and where did it come from?
This is a track, it's the second track off Cowboy in Sweden, which he made in the early 70s. This is a duet with Nina Lazell, who was a Swedish singer. This was actually the second song I ever heard him sing. The first one was the first track on the album, and this is the one that, my brain melted.
Ran into town, leaving her gown of lace in a place by the door. Now the leather lace still hangs in place, but I never see her anymore.
For me, the remarkable stuff is these solo records that he made in the second half of the 60s and into the 70s. I mean, starting in when he was living in America, he made his first solo record, Trouble is a Lonesome Town, is just remarkable. Every song has this little introduction about these sort of weird characters that that are based upon people he knew when he was growing up in Depression-era America. He'd been born in Oklahoma and spent time in Texas, where his father was a wildcatter, like working on the oil rigs. And Trouble is a Lonesome Town is full of these kind of strange little vignettes, and then these beautiful songs like We All Make the Little Flowers Grow, which is basically about how we're all going to die. And yet it sounds like the most chirpy song you've ever heard. So he did that, and Requiem for an Almost Lady, which is one of the saddest breakup records ever made. And then, in the 70s, he went and made these just surreal records in Sweden, like Cowboy in Sweden, whose title tells you everything you need to know about just how strange it is. He made strange little films there. I mean, everything from sort of almost stream of consciousness documentaries about the similarity between his upbringing in America and the lifestyle that he'd found on this island in Sweden called Gotland. He did TV specials. I mean, he won a Montreux Golden Rose Prize for a TV special on behalf of Sweden, beating Barbara Streisand, which made him so happy.
I also wanted to ask, you mentioned Steve Shelley and Sonic Youth, and those guys kind of around the sort of late 90s, they were doing quite a lot of sort of digging out these obscure American lost idols in a way, because they sort of did a lot for sort of John Fahey's music as well, and they were kind of into Lee Hazlewood as well. What was Lee's stature around that time in the sort of cultural canon? How were people approaching his work then? Was it cool to be a Lee Hazlewood fan?
I think it was definitely cool to be a Lee Hazlewood fan, and it had been for quite a while. I mean, back in the early 90s, there was an attempt by Sub Pop to put together a tribute album, which Lee just stamped all over. He was having none of it. And I think at that point, Lee did think that he was maybe a figure of fun. I mean, he really undervalued his own work, aside from the stuff that earned him money, which was how he valued. You know, he measured the success of his work by money. I don't think he really measured it any other way, or he didn't dare measure it any other way publicly. So yeah, Sub Pop had tried to do something, and Lee had said no. And there was this community of people who were like massive, massive fans of Lee. I mean, Jesus and Mary Chain, Nick Cave, Einstürz und Neubauten and Lydia Lunch, all these people had done cover versions of his songs, really intense cover versions of his stuff. But he didn't really realize that. So I think he had great cachet. I don't think he was seen as kitsch by any of these people. For me, there were two really significant moments in the sort of development of his understanding of where he's, you know, what his status was. And one of them was at the end of the show that he performed at the Royal Festival Hall in 1999. And that was the first show he'd ever performed solo in Britain. And I'd helped arrange that for the Nick Cave Meltdown Festival. And he came off afterwards and he was just beaming from ear to ear, because there'd been some comment, people were shouting out from the audience, you know, oh, we love you, Lee. And he was just like, you know, where were you when I needed you? And they were just like, well, we weren't even born yet.
Yeah.
And this, I think, really stunned him to realize that these were people that, you know, he thought the only people who knew about his music were his generation. He had no idea there were people who were rooting through dusty, boxes in charity stores trying to find his records and willing to spend large amounts of money. And then there was another moment, which I write about in the book, actually, in some depth, where shortly before he died, I had brought over to Vegas, where he lived, a collection of his records, which I'd managed to get digitized, because he didn't have most of his own records. And I sat with him. We put this little Bose CD player, the ones you see in catalogues, you know, I put that in front of us and we sat there and he asked me to play his version of It Was a Very Good Year. And he just sort of drifted off during the course of the song. And when it finished, we sat there and, you know, another moment's silence. And then he turned to me and he just went, you know what? I quite like me. And honestly, I nearly burst into tears because I'd been waiting for him to say that for 8 years. It was just like a magical moment for him to actually see him realise, God, I was quite good, wasn't I? It was fantastic.
That was Tom Hall speaking to Wyndham Wallace about the genius of Lee Hazlewood.
Up next, we'll be going for a midnight stroll with author Matthew Beaumont.
From a 71-year-old barber to a century-old cafe owner, Monocle Films visits Japan's sprightly elderly who are showing little sign of letting up.
For many in this long-living country, the official retirement age is merely a number. Up and down the country, many people in Japan are working well into their 70s and 80s, and sometimes even beyond. 100-year-old Ichiro Sekiguchi says that working has kept him fit. Today, he is still in charge at Café de l'Ombre, the coffee house he opened in Ginza in 1948.
Older, wiser, and going strong. Senior style in Japan. Premiering now in the film section on Monocle.com.
For many creative minds, the night time is where ideas really take flight. No distractions, no schedules, and no sleep, if that spark of an idea is worth staying up for. Matthew Beaumont is senior lecturer in the Department of English at University College London, and his scholarly eye hasn't missed the fact that many of our greatest tomes depict the city during its glowing, mysterious best at night.
Beaumont has compiled a handsome new volume of some of the best depictions of the wee small hours, Nightwalking, A Nocturnal History of London, featuring writing from poets, authors, thinkers and drinkers, who range from Chaucer to William Blake. Andrew Tuck met Matthew earlier to discuss the book and began by asking why the idea of the nighttime holds a very particular appeal.
Matthew, let's start with the idea for the book. What made you think that there was a whole history to be written of the people who walk around at night, who inhabit the dark times of day?
I suppose when I first started walking at night myself, and that was very important to the formation of the book and to the idea behind the book, I didn't realise that there was a long tradition in literature of people who did the same thing. But through my teaching at UCL in the English department, I realised that a lot of the writers that I'm most interested in had themselves gone out into the streets at night in London in order to discover the city's underside and in order to show solidarity with the homeless and the vagrant population who lived there, and that it had fed in really interesting and, I thought, unexamined ways into their poetry and their prose.
And tell me, what is that dividing line? So I think that Dickens says there are two times of night in your book. He says, you know, there's that glittering part, that the first part of the night when the lights come on and twinkle and there's, you know, jubilation and people out drinking and carousing, and then it shifts into this darker zone. And, you know, not just darker in the sense of amount of light, you know, that's when things could go wrong is the sense that you get. Just explain to us how night operates in that way.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right in sketching it in those terms. There are certainly, for Dickens, two nights, as you say. There's the social or sociable night, the one which is really a product of the 18th century and the 19th, a product of the new technology of public street lighting, which emerges actually in the late 17th century. And that is the kind of night in which shops remain open, crowds form on the streets in order to window shop or to do their shopping. People are coming home from work, people are going out to drink or to celebrate, as you say. And then there's the what I call the asocial night or the antisocial night. So that's sometimes called by Dickens the dead night, the period from about 2 till 4 or 5, almost till the dawn, when everything quietens down. And in fact, even in today's city, the 24-hour city, supposedly, one still gets a sense, I think, of the dead night, even under the electric lights. And that's the night in which stragglers on the streets become very rare, when the stragglers that do appear on the streets appear either threatening or feel threatened. It's the night when, as you say, things could go wrong, when everything seems a little uncertain, where the city itself begins to change and seem unfamiliar, and in a sense the self too, one's sense of oneself begins to alter and to feel rather alien.
But so strange, most people are tucked up in their beds, and there's these few hours where it's charged in your book with a sense of, you know, yes, danger, but also sex, of all sorts of mysterious undercurrents. And I guess that's why your book points out that it's populated mostly by men, and the women who are there are to be judged either as, you know, sex workers or as prey almost.
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted in the first place to write a narrative account of this tradition of night walking and of the city at night from the Middle Ages up to the 19th century without including much more about women. But the fact is, it's extremely hard to find women who inhabit the streets at night, particularly in the dead night, as you say, particularly in that antisocial or asocial period of the night. And in that period, above all, women are either regarded as highly suspicious, they're assumed to be sexually predatory, in other words, they're assumed to be prostitutes or sex workers, as we'd call them today, or they are thought to be so vulnerable to predation, if you like, from men, the men who inhabit the streets at that time, few and far between though they may be, that again, they're defined in really quite negative and demeaning terms. So I'm afraid, much to my regret, it turned out to be a story about men at night. And I further regret it has to be said that in today's city too, that situation prevails to some extent. I mean, of course, electric lighting has made a difference, and various other, and the, you know, the women's movement and, you know, certain social developments. But in fact, you know, women on the streets at night still today at that time of the night are regarded either as prey or predator, really.
I'm always struck when you drive through to the east of London and you drive along some of those roads very early in the morning, if you're going to work, incredibly early, when it was still dark, and there's that cusp from night to morning where you'd see prostitutes and sex workers working exactly the same spots that they'd worked in Victorian times, you know, that unchanged pattern. But take us back. You've touched, you know, fascinatingly on the notion of the technology and how that has changed the night in some ways, you know, the street lights, for example. But take us back to the beginning of your book and the medieval times, the early city, when light was a valuable commodity. You know, you had to buy a candle. It wasn't a flick of a switch. And darkness, I guess, in winter would have fallen, as it does now, at 3 o'clock. So the night was a much darker, longer. What was our relationship with the night then?
Well, it was defined by fear, I think, above all. I mean, really ancient, if not primal, fear of the night prevailed in the Middle Ages, the time when legal recriminations against so-called night walkers, vagrants who were out in the streets at night, began to be instituted. And the night was felt to be a completely different metaphysical and physical condition, really, to the day. So, for example, Thomas Dekker, who was a contemporary and collaborator of Shakespeare's, writes about the thick tobacco breath of the rheumatic night. And there was a sense, and it appears in the medical literature of the time too, that the night was physically different, that it was toxic in some way. And not only that it was toxic and that it contained all these impurities, these pollutants that the air in the day didn't, but that it was inherently frightening, alien, other, and even ungodly. So it was a quite different place, and that's true of the city as well as the countryside in the Middle Ages. In the city, the curfew was imposed from the late 11th century and lasted probably, you know, two or three centuries. And so the night was very sharply demarcated from the day, because there would be ringing of bells, the gates into the city walls would be closed, and the night watchman would emerge to police the night.
And those people who police the night, they're policing it because of a fear of insurrection, of traitors, or because of morality?
I think largely because of morality. I mean, the curfew was introduced by William I in the late 11th century, ostensibly to prevent fire. The word curfew comes from the French couvre-feu, in other words, cover fire. It was about covering your fire, your hearth fire, as well as your candles, in order to prevent fire. Of course, a lot of the buildings in the city were made of wood. But probably also just as importantly, in order to prevent political conspiracies, which used to take place at night, used to be hatched at night. But, you know, as the centuries wore on, I think, the night watchman's role was above all to police property, to protect the property of the possessing classes, the property classes, and to preserve certain moral boundaries, as you imply.
Now, your book takes us and introduces us to authors, poets, a whole range of people who were fascinated with the night. Tell us a story of one that sticks in your mind that would be a good illustration for our listeners about a writer that was fascinated with those hours of darkness.
It's been written about before, so it's not an entirely original section of the book, but perhaps the most fascinating in a way is the figure of Samuel Johnson, because we assume Samuel Johnson was this monumental literary figure, this almost sort of statuesque character in literary and British literary and cultural history, who presided over the culture and civilization of England in the 18th century with his monumental dictionary and all the other things. But in fact, when he was a young man, he was both an inveterate walker and, like so many Grub Street poets, as they were known, who were on the make in the early 18th century, extremely poor and, if not indeed, virtually homeless. And he befriended, as a young man on the make, a very dissolute character called Richard Savage, who was himself a poet who seems to have led in part a kind of fantasy life. He claimed to be the bastard child of an aristocratic family that had shut him out. And the two of them, he'd been imprisoned for murder, incidentally, on the streets of London at night. The two of them used to walk around railing against the Whig government and expressing a certain solidarity with the homeless people on the streets. And Savage certainly slept on the street. In particular, he'd sleep next to the glass factories, because the bricks of the building that allowed the glass that had been made to cool emitted a warmth that was extremely comforting to homeless people. So it seems that Johnson, as well as Savage, slept against these walls on the streets of the night when Johnson was a young man.
And Matthew, finally, just tell me your own fascination with being out there in the dark, walking at night. Is there still an air of suspicion now? Because, you know, I suddenly wonder why. Do people, when you tell them about your passion for this, are they intrigued what you're really up to?
They back off very quickly. funnily enough, in London, where I've done most of my night walking for obvious reasons, because I live here, because that's, you know, the topic of my book, I've rarely been picked up by the, well, I haven't been picked up by the police. I've been rarely subjected to too much surveillance. In Paris, I was both abused by youths and various other people and attracted suspicion from the police. There's no doubt that it still does at night generate just slightly odd glances, to put it mildly. But I do think that, you know, the city is such a different place at night. You know, there was a writer, an English writer called Ford Madox Ford at the beginning of the 20th century, who writes about how we forget in our daily lives that the city that we live in, he was writing specifically about London, is built on hills and in valleys and over fields and underground rivers. Going out at night somehow reminds you of that. The city becomes more feral, if you like, at night.
But how wonderful you find a thread both in literature and in our real lives that, you know, tugs us all the way back to medieval times and runs all the way through our history of London. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
That was Matthew Beaumont talking to Monocle's Andrew Tuck. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
And there we have it, Steve. That was edition 299 of The Monocle Weekly. That was nice, wasn't it? It hung together rather nicely as a show, I hope.
It did indeed. And I must say, very much looking forward to edition 300, the big 300.
Yeah, I wonder what will happen.
I don't know. Stay tuned.
Well, thank you, Vo. We should thank our team behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. And our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time next week, possibly with the same personnel on board. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Steve Bloomfield.
Thanks for tuning in.